This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.
Nick Helm just, and Nathaniel Metcalf's just fan club on FUBAR Radio.
Start the show when it's time to start the show. Making some notes. I'm allowed to make some notes before the show starts, right? I'm allowed to make notes right up until the last, the nub of the, but as long as I'm starting the show on the hour, it's all right. Anyway, happy International Women's Day. Having a lovely old time in the studio.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's fan club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're on the air. My name's Nick Helm.
And my name is Nathaniel Metcalf. Good afternoon.
And you're listening to...
Nick.
And Nat.
Fan club.
First rule of fan club is
tell your friends about fan club.
And the second rule of fan club
is please, for the love of God,
tell your friends about fan. I thought my headphones were a little quiet, and I just realised I was wearing my hat over my ears. We're celebrating International Women's Day today with our 37th consecutive white male guest.
We've done it again.
We had two of the drunk women on last week. It's fine. One of them was a repeat, but that's all right. She still counts as a separate guest. So, what have you been a fan of this? I'm a bit out of sorts because I've moved. I moved house on Wednesday. I'll tell you this.
You got no internet connection?
I've got no internet, but also I can't find my clothes.
Stay in one of the boxes.
We're lucky because I mean, this is terrible, but we're getting ready to shoot the next series of Reluctant Landlord, which is basically, it's a 7-week shoot where you give your life over to a production company and they pick you up in the morning, they drop you off at night, you go to bed and then they pick you up in the morning and then they drop you off at night, and then you're exhausted in the weekends. Basically, I moved house on Wednesday. Was the last day that I could move. I had to be out of my old flat. And they said, you've got a rehearsal for Reluctant Landlord. I just had some Pepsi Max Cherry. I didn't get any of Levi Roots' stuff today.
No, he didn't. He could have done. No. We're in the right shop. We're in Nisa.
I'm not going to do this, though, because I listened back to last week's fan club and I set up about 3 things that I'm going to finish off, and I never finish any of the stuff off.
Sure.
What I was going to say about Alice Cooper, I've done it now because I'm right. What I was going to say about Alice Cooper was because that song that I played last week was not good. It's all right. It's off a very interesting album. It's like a new wave. He did a new wave album in 1980, Flash the Fashion, 1980. And there's about 3 albums that he did in a row, which were all a bit weird. And then when you get up to 2001, when he did Brutal Planet, he sort of like did an industrial metal album, which was a bit like Marilyn Manson inspired. And what I was saying last week was there was a point in history where he was inventing things. And then they got to like the late 70s, early 80s, where you felt like he was trying to keep up with the current trends.
Same thing happened with Bowie as well, when he was sort of chasing the kind of drum and bassy type thing in the 90s.
And also when the Muppets took off, he thought, I'll have a piece of that pie.
That's what he thought, yeah.
Yeah, I don't really see a problem because it's, you listen to the songs in isolation.
It's all part of a career, isn't it? It's all part of a... Mm. It all adds up to a career.
In a way.
I think that is interesting, that he is like... But he is still... I think the thing that you don't think about Alice Cooper, or I don't, as someone who's not like a super fan, is that you think of him as being this one thing for forever. And actually, he's doing all kinds... Like, he's just like a sort of working musician for...
Yeah, but also, the Alice Cooper that I think that you probably that most people would instantly associate with is the late 80s Alice Cooper, Poison Alice Cooper, where he wears leather jackets and he's got big black hair.
I suppose so. But I think of the sort of 70s, I think, the sort of horror influence.
Sure.
Alice Cooper.
But he still wears leather jackets now, and he didn't really up until the late 80s, was my point. And that was based on the fact that Motley Crue and Bon Jovi and Aerosmith were really big in the mid-80s. And he was sort of like going, oh, he'd taken 4 years off to get over his addictions. And then when he came back, he was like sober. And he was, you know, and they were like looking at his comeback album was Constrictor, which was awful. I can't listen to it. Then there's Raise Your Fist and Yell, which I don't think is a good album. And then he did Trash, which, if you look at all the people that that worked on Trash, like Steven Tyler does backing vocals on it, Bon Jovi does backing vocals on it. Is it Desmond Child that produced it? Everyone that is big at that moment, I think it was 88, was on.
And they're all Alice Cooper fans from their youth.
Yeah, and it's like it's his big comeback album, and it's all right, but they're all sex songs, and now he's a Christian. He doesn't sing any of them other than Poison, which he has to because that's his biggest hit outside of School's Out. And then even like something that's as iconic as that Trash album is basically him chasing a trend, which is, oh, well, everyone wears leather jackets now.
Yeah.
And I think when he went back and did his concept album, when he went back and did The Last Temptation, that's when it was like, oh, it's like, that's like, that's classic Alice Cooper, I think. Anyway, the other thing I was saying about it was the character Keanu in the Steve Coogan tour.
Yes.
Which was the weird thing about that character was that when they announced the tour, it was kind of like an Animal House poster.
I can't remember.
And he was on the poster. Like, it's an illustrated poster of all of Steve Coogan's characters. And Keanu was on the poster, like, oh, hang on a minute, he's going to do a 10-minute spot as Keanu, who's like a character that was in a couple of episodes of Saxondale. And then he mysteriously disappeared. He was mentioned in one interview really early on, and then he's never mentioned ever again. And it's kind of weird that there was a point in time that Steve Coogan valued that character so much that he was going to, like...
Yeah. Do you reckon it just might have been one of those things where when he came to have to write 10 minutes, he was like, I can't do it.
I think it's absolutely that. I think this character has got no legs.
Yeah.
No, that's a bad thing. So those were two things. There was a third thing that I couldn't remember that we were talking about last week. Anyway, there you go. This week, so we've got rehearsals.
So if you didn't understand that, if you weren't listening last week...
Just go back and
go back, listen to last week's
episode.
And then we'll...
Tell your friends, please.
Listen to last week's episode.
Please, I'm moving house and... everyone was like, it's very stressful moving house. It's having a baby... moving house, and I don't know, there was another one that was really stressful.
Getting married?
Maybe. Probably getting married. And I got all the way up to like last weekend. I was like, this isn't stressful at all. And then all of a sudden, it's just like everything. And we were like saying that when you start off like packing your house, you're kind of like, you're very selective over, oh, I think I'll keep this. This is a happy memory. This is a fond memory. Whenever I look at this mug, it reminds me of that holiday I had in Florida and the roller coaster that I bought this from the gift shop. And I remember who I was with at that time. And then you get to the day of the move and you're literally just throwing out baby photos. You're just like going, fuck it! Got no room for this in my place! God! Pack the van! Pack the van! That doesn't matter! But it's your wedding dress. Shred it. And the move was fucking stressful. But on top of that, they said, "Oh, you need to come in for a 4-hour rehearsal for Reluctant Landlord in the morning."
Moving day.
I know. I was just like, "Oh, is there any way that you can move into the Thursday? Because I'm free all day on Thursday. I've moved then." And they were like, no. So that was really, really stressful. So I was wearing the same pair of pants for 3 days. And I've just found like a laundry basket of clean laundry.
Good.
But I still haven't found any trousers. So I'm wearing my gym sweats. I've got my jumper on, but under my jumper I'm wearing a fucking vest that I found. I mean, I'm wearing a vest, yeah, and I'm wearing stained, sweaty gym trousers. I found one pair of clean pants. I'm wearing yesterday's socks.
We're on it.
I've been so stressed that my eczema has come out on my face, and I've looked better. I'm just kind of like, oh, it's just, but it is stressful. Anyway, we're on air.
Nick and Nat's Fan Club.
That's the show. So anyway, we've got some new buttons this week.
Have we?
We've got 9, 10, 11... 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. We've got 8 new cues. So let's go through them. Oh, why don't you say something? What's this fucking story that you had about someone buying toilet paper in Iceland?
I've no idea. That's what I. that's what we needed Chris Boyd to tell us.
So he said,
oh, that reminds me of that story you
told.
So
you posted a picture of some toilet paper.
That's right, because
tell a story.
Well, I posted a picture of some toilet paper because it had a funny thing on it.
Where's the toilet paper from?
Tesco's. It's exclusively from Tesco's, and I thought that was a funny thing that they would advertise on toilet paper as if that was like a super exclusive thing, like exclusively at Tesco's toilet paper. And Chris Boyd replied, oh, I can't get over that story you told me about the bloke buying toilet paper in Iceland. And I was like, I don't know what story this is.
So you don't remember the story?
Yeah. No idea.
That's,
is that it?
That's
is that
button
that
16.
That was nice.
Okay. That's cool. Button 14. I'm going to save button 15 till last because that one looks particularly exciting.
All right. Button. Applause.
That's the studio applause. I mean, what you've done here, Natalie, is you've put 8 new sound effects up on the thing, but what you haven't done is a lot of them are like almost identical to each other. So you've made it look like you've been busy, but in actual fact, you've Googled one thing, which is sound effects of cheering. Yeah, fuck you. Jesus Christ. Okay, this one better be good. It's a shotgun with cock.
Couldn't hear the cock in that, though.
I've just understood what...
Got it.
So what have you been a fan of this week, Nat?
You know what I've been?
I haven't got any internet, so I haven't done any research. I've watched 3 films, but we'll talk about that a bit later. Ladies and gentlemen, somewhere you've got that to look forward to. In the meantime, Nat's going to be telling us what he's been a fan of. I'm just going to pop out to the toilet. You take a minute. What have you been a fan of this week, Nat?
I'll tell you what I've been doing. I've been watching. I've decided to have a Hugh Grant season.
Oh, I have
and watch some old Hugh Grant movies.
Yeah,
because I always think, God, I love Hugh Grant.
I do love Hugh Grant.
Love him. Yeah. Love him. Always have as well.
Yeah,
I've got.
When was the first moment he came into your life?
Four Weddings.
Obviously. I mean, there's no point in pretending that, you know, you're a big fan of that Mary Shelley film and Lair of the White Worm when you were 9. But
I liked it later.
I've seen it. I've retrospectively gone back and Lair of the White Worm. What a movie. Absolutely bonkers. What's the Mary Shelley one that he did?
Was it Gothic? Is he?
Yeah, Gothic. Gothic with Timothy Spall. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he is proper sort of light comic actor in a way that you just don't get now. And I think interestingly, I watched About a Boy, which was when he sort of, it was, I guess, that and Bridget Jones is when he kind of reinvented himself as sort of being
American
a bit
Dreams
more, Yeah,
don't forget, American Dreams.
Yeah, yeah. But that's it, because he's now sort of reinvented himself, hasn't he, as being like a bit of a dickhead kind of person in films.
Being a bit cuntish, bit edgy, bit of a lad, bit of a... Whereas,
but you forget that, like, you've had all that period where you now that's become who Hugh Grant is. But you had that period where
He started off making films like Lair of the White Worm, Gothic, and then he became famous for... Four Incident and Funeral, but then there was a man that went...
Englishman who went up a hill.
And it's kind of like, that's the sort of film that you would have made before Four Weddings.
Oh, yeah, I think there's a few films like that that maybe had been completed that they were like, hold on to that. Or it felt like he had about four films out within about 3 months of Four Weddings.
And they were like, Four Weddings is going to be big.
Yeah, and they've suddenly gone, put that on the schedule. So he had that. He
Four Weddings is going to be really big. It's got John Hannah in it. Keep that under your hat. I suspect that the Englishman went up a hill and came down a mountain and was filmed before Four Weddings.
Or it's at least weird. Was probably like he's contracted to do it.
Yeah, it would be a bit of a weird follow-up to Four Weddings to do a film that no one's really got any interest in seeing, outside of the fact that Hugh Grant's in it. Was Alan Rickman in that?
No, he was in one called An Awfully Big Adventure that came out.
That's right. That feels like a similar thing.
Yeah, I think that was like because a TV thing as well. I think it was a BBC film.
And then they cinematically released it. Because then after Four Weddings, he went off and he did stuff like Extreme Measures. Was it, which one? Is it Desperate Measures or Extreme Measures?
Extreme Measures. I've never seen Extreme Measures.
Oh, it's good.
I might try and watch it in my season.
So Extreme Measures is the one with Hugh Grant and Gene Hackman. Mm-hmm. And Desperate Measures is the one with Andy Garcia and Michael Keaton. Is that correct?
Oh, right. Yeah.
And then there's another one that's similar, got a similar title, Desperate Intentions. No, I don't know. It's like, have you seen Basic? Have you seen Instinct? Have you seen Basic Instinct? Hasn't Basic and Instinct both got Anthony Hopkins in it? Look that up. I think Basic... It's like Anthony Hopkins always regretted not being in Basic Instinct. And so he went off and he made Basic and Instinct. Yeah, why did you do that? I've got a great idea for a movie. Instinct Basic.
Okay, and Tom Jones has just come in. He's not in Basic. Anthony Hopkins.
Who's in Basic? John Travolta. John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson. Maybe all three of them wanted to... Nah, it doesn't work like that.
Doesn't work like that.
I always wished I was in Men in Black, so I made three films. One called Men, one called In. This is not the vintage fan club, is it? it's not going to be on a compilation of our best ones.
We don't know.
Depends how bad they get. We don't know what's happening because I haven't been given my schedule for the filming over the next 7 weeks.
No, we don't know.
So we don't know if we've got to do pre-records, if I'm free next Friday. This could be the last fan club for 7 weeks.
It won't be. But you might, you know.
Both of them are always telling me I'm easily replaceable. But when I'm on the air, I manage to swallow my disappointment and humiliation and I put on my cocksure persona. But inside I'm crying because it's a...
Shotgun very, and cock?
It's a very different story when we're not on the air.
That sounded much more sinister, right?
I am disappointed. Could you actually get the sound effect of a cock? I don't know what it would sound like.
What would it sound like?
What do you think it would sound like? What do you think it would sound like?
The sound of a cock?
Yeah.
That's a good point, isn't it? If you can't hear a cock, does it really exist?
Just like do an impression of what you think it would be like.
An impression?
Yeah.
What it would sound like?
Yeah.
What's it doing? Just being a cock?
Yeah.
Oh. Probably go. No.
That's not very accurate. Go on, try and make it sound as realistic and accurate as possible.
I thought that was realistic.
Try and make it sound as realistic as possible. Go on.
I don't know. You do it. Yes. That's good, isn't it?
What were you thinking?
I was thinking of a man's cock.
Oh, Nat. Oh. Oh. For the listeners at home, I am sorry about that. it's like that radio. It's like that radio. There was that radio call-in thing. Was it? It's probably an urban myth. Legend, urban myth. And there's a radio calling. Go, to win a prize, we want to know where the craziest place you've ever had sex is. And this woman's on the line, and they're like, so tell us, where's the craziest place you've ever had sex? She goes, no, I can't tell you. Go on, tell us. You can win like £1,000. No, I can't tell you. Go on, where's the craziest place you've ever had sex? All right, in the ass. And it's meant to be kind of like. But it's not that crazy. It's 2019. It's aged, that anecdote, I would say.
Yes,
sounds like very mid to late 80s to me. Mm. Anyway, about the time that Hugh Grant was filming Gothic.
Well, I think it's interesting because after Four Weddings, he had a career and his job was almost like he tried extreme measures. That was made by his own production company. But in general, what people wanted to see him in was romantic comedies.
Can we get out Hugh Grant's IMDb page on our screen?
And it's like, because you think of it, it's quite unusual that he was a star of romantic comedies. But it's sort of unusual, I guess, that he's, you know, it's from a sort of male perspective as well. I watched the rewrite as well.
Oh, that's fucking awful.
I thought, do you know what? It's the second time, the first time I saw it, I liked it. This time I liked it less, but I think it's a bit weird. And it's like he's the sort of protagonist of this romantic comedy, but he's not. It's like it's all very male-focused, and it's weird because it's this sort of rom-com, which you don't expect to be sort of very male-focused sort of rom-com.
We've talked about it before, but there's the Hugh Grant B picture formula, which is basically what the Hugh Grant A picture formula was you get Hugh Grant, put him with an American actress, and watch the fireworks explode. So, Four Weddings and a Funeral, you've got Andy McDowell, I love Andy McDowell, but when you're thinking about the biggest actresses on the planet, or female actors, you look at Julia Roberts and you go, she is number one. So in this next one, it's just like, right, okay, put Hugh Grant with Julia Roberts, and that is a huge film. And then it was just kind of like, then he tried some other stuff, and then it was just like, oh, it's the same guy. It's the guy that directed Miss Congeniality and 2 Weeks' Notice. So he directed...
Mark Lawrence, he's called.
Is that what he's called? Yeah. So he directed Miss Congeniality with Sandra Bullock, and then he did a follow-up film with Sandra Bullock called 2 Weeks' Notice, which co-starred Hugh Grant. And it was a Sandra Bullock vehicle, and Hugh Grant came in to be like the romantic male love interest. And they must have got on so well because they followed that up with Did You Hear About the Morgans?
Music and lyrics. And the rewrite.
And obviously, Did You Hear About the Morgans? I think it was Music and Lyrics with Drew Barrymore. Did You Hear About the Morgans with Sarah Jessica Parker? And the rewrite with Marissa Tomei. And the only one out of all, I think that fucking. You know what 2 Weeks' Notice is going in, and they don't make the film. They don't make the film that is really clearly obvious. You know, you go 2 Weeks' Notice. Sandra Bullock did another film with him, I think, Ryan Reynolds.
Oh yes, yeah, you're right. I think they're the same film.
The Proposal. The Proposal. I've still got the FUBAR. I haven't got the thing up.
Oh, is it on the shared doc?
Oh, right, there you go. Next time someone comes in here before the show and starts fucking around with all the computer screens, can we just make sure that they've been put back the way I need them so that I can actually professionally run a show? I haven't pressed mute. Anyway, so Sirens, yeah.
Sirens, of course, Sirens.
Restoration, Sense and Sensibility. Fucking hell, what a movie.
Great movie.
Great.
Incredible
movie. It's a great fucking movie. That's great. I mean,
and that gets to be, Hugh Grant gets to be Hugh Grant again in the context of Jane Austen. Absolutely brilliant film, Sense and Sensibility.
It is. Obviously the cast is incredible, but it's also got, Alan Rickman in it. Yeah. Dead. 9 months. That was like kind
his
of
big
like,
American.
That
movie.
Was like, hey, this. I reckon. So he made Sirens, Restoration. He probably did Sense and Sensibility after Four Weddings.
Yeah, still a good job for him.
It was a real good job, and it was just kind of like, okay, you've done Four Weddings. You prove your star power with Sense and Sensibility, or it's a nice way of going, having a supporting part.
Yeah,
and then once you've done that, you're going to go over to America. You're going to make 9 months. Get a blow job, and then you're going to come back and we'll release... But don't worry about that, because we've got Englishmen Who Went Up a Hill and Came Down a Mountain.
We've got that in the bank.
We've got that in the bank.
Made in 1993, probably. Englishmen Who Went Up a Hill but Came Down a Mountain.
Which should have been called Englishmen Who Went Over to Hollywood and Came Back with His Tail Between His Legs. Because that's what happened. Then there was an awfully big adventure. I literally had no interest in seeing that. Extreme Measures. Mickey Blue Eyes
is one of the ones I've watched. This week,
really enjoyed that.
Really like it.
It's it came out. It didn't come out quite the. Yeah, it did. It came out the same year as Analyze This.
Did it really?
And it was kind of like they were like, oh, they've made two. I think it's the winner of the two. I love James Caan.
Oh, he's terrific in it. It's like it's and generally what it is. Well, I'm saying it's brilliant. What it is, it's a 3-star movie. But I think people think it's a bad movie.
Forget about it, yours. Yeah. I mean, it's not a good movie.
The bit where he actually tries to do the foreign accent in the restaurant is genuinely really funny. And I think it's because he actually can't do it. Yeah. And I think you are watching someone who's supposed to be doing a bad accent, but it's so bad that you can't quite...
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. Notting Hill. I don't like that film. Small Time. I watched Small Time Crooks this week.
I really liked Small. Did you? This week?
Yeah, I watched it on. I watched it on Sunday. Maybe no. Yeah, maybe.
I haven't seen it since it came out, but I've got fond memories of Small Time Crooks.
The thing about Small Time Crooks is it's a Woody Allen movie, mm-hmm. right? So everything aside, all the political stuff aside, I saw it at the cinema. Mm-hmm. What year was it? 2001. 2000. I saw it at the cinema. I've got fond memories of it, right?
Me too.
And I sort of really, really liked it, but it's not a perfect film. And then when I watched it again, I thought it was like a film of two halves, basically, where the first half is all very sort of like light and funny, and the second half gets bogged down in kind of like Pygmalion. And actually, Hugh Grant, as soon as his character comes in, like the film's over, really. But then we watched it again, and it's like it's a half hour of good stuff, and then there's an hour of kind of like average stuff. It's a weird film. Gonna just press the old
spoiler.
You have been warned.
you had 19 years.
If you haven't seen Small Time Crooks, then shame on you. So the first half hour is really kind of I think it's the funniest thing that Woody Allen has ever made. Right?
I think it was I remember it being like a return to like, yeah, he's doing like funny stuff again. It's like a funny film.
It's like it's like one of his early funny Woody Allen films.
And it's Woody Allen, Hugh Grant, Tracy Ullman.
Yeah, Woody Allen, Tracy Ullman, Hugh Grant, and then it's got Michael Rapaport, John Lovitz, and there were some others. I can't remember.
Yeah, it's a good cast.
It's a good. Well, he always gets good casts. He always got good casts. So the first half hour is basically, and what I think really works about it is that he's not playing as an intellectual, right? He's playing an idiot, and I mean he's great at playing an idiot, and like all of his films get bogged down. When the characters are talking explicitly about Woody Allen's own philosophical opinions, and you just what was that fucking awful film? That Magic in the Moonlight, or Moonlight and Magic, or
I think there is one I've not seen.
It's got my man crush Colin Firth in it with Emma Stone. Magic in the Moonlight. And I didn't know what it was. I was watching it at home, and it had like, oh, it's got a good cast. It's got Colin Firth, and Emma Stone in it. And then it comes up and it's got like...
Yeah, you know, the type. Since you've seen the type.
There's jazz music and with white writing on black. And yeah. I was like, oh, it's not fucking latter-day Woody Allen, is it? And then it's just like, oh, anything but this. And we've committed to it. This is our pick of the evening. And now we're watching... Oh, fuck me. It's just like, is there anything worse than accent?
Oh, okay.
But because, you know, of all the stuff that's happened, they don't promote Woody Allen films with Woody Allen anymore. So it's just like, hey, starring Colin Firth and Emma Stone. And you go, fucking hell, I'm going to watch that. And then the fucking jazz starts and you go, oh, no, it's not. It's post-2000 Woody Allen, which is awful. It's just awful. Anyway, I think maybe Small Town Crooks is his last good film. So he's playing an idiot, and you get half an hour of just jokes. And what is really unusual for a Woody Allen film is it's really fastly paced, and all the characters are basically talking about the plot, so which never happens. Normally what happens is that the plot gets explained really, like when he got lazy and not as good, and he was just doing one a year because he'd had a personal bet with himself that he could do it.
That's but what it feels like.
But it's just, so they'll go, hey, oh my god, you're a magician and you're gonna woo this lady, and then it's just them talking for hours and hours and it's so unrealistic. But with this it's kind of like there is a plot and they're all talking about the plot and there's jokes that come out of the plot and it's all driven by the plot, and at no point does anyone sit down and just almost directly talk to the camera about what their philosophies are. And it's just kind of like, and it's so funny, every single character in it is a complete moron, and it's half an hour of that, and then all of a sudden it's about a couple that it's about Woody Allen and Tracy Ullman, that basically he's a robber. He's a bank robber, and they're trying to get rich. And so Woody Allen is going to rob. He buys a bakery that's two doors down from a bank as a cover, and he's basically going to tunnel under with his mates and rob the bank. Meanwhile, Tracy Ullman, to keep the cover going, bakes cookies in the shop, and then they take off. And then because the cookies take off, they become multimillionaires. And then the second half is like a high society comedy. Not the second half, the main bulk of the movie, which is the hour. It's an hour and a half. And the main bulk of the movie is basically they become millionaires, multimillionaires, and they become part of high society. And it's weird because Tracy Ullman is the character that made them millionaires by becoming... She's a really great cook. She has this hidden skill that nobody knew. Oh, she's a really good baker. And she's got this hidden skill that nobody knew that she had. And then all of a sudden it really takes off. And it's just like, hey, well, maybe we don't have to rob banks anymore. Maybe we can just, rely on you being good at something to give us some money. And then the second half of the film is about her thinking that her life isn't good enough, so she mingles with high society. And she plays an idiot, and Woody Allen plays an idiot, but you get the feeling that Woody Allen, the filmmaker, is judging Tracy Ullman's character. Because Tracy Ullman's character is kind of like, oh, what's for dinner tonight? Oh, I've made snails. And Woody Allen's going, oh, I don't want to eat snails, I want a cheeseburger. And it's kind of like, and he's kind of like saying, oh, I might have money. Right, that wasn't a great Woody Allen impression, I have to say. But in my pantheon of
really
amazing,
okay.
Oh boy, I like a cheeseburger. I can't do it. See, I'm very ill though.
Yeah,
still ill. Still, nothing like 2 hours of breathing into a shared microphone. That has all of Food Bar come down.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm taking down the station. So you've basically got Woody Allen saying, money's not changed me.
Yes.
I still like a cheeseburger and watch the baseball and playing. I like to play cards with my friends. Whereas Tracy Ullman's character, money does change her and she wants to better herself and grow as a person. But at the end of the film, she's the one that gets basically abused and ripped off by everyone. And she comes back to Woody Allen. And you go, well... It's the first half hour is brilliant because everyone's equal, they're all idiots. Second hour is kind of like they're still all idiots, but you've got the feeling that the filmmaker, who is also the lead actor, is kind of like judging the other characters, and it's, it leaves like a really, not a really horrific bitter taste in the mouth, but it doesn't work. You're kind of like, oh, that's a shame. Because rather than celebrate her, they've kind of, and it is International Women's Day, rather than celebrate her, he's kind of like, he's gone, oh yeah, well she's playing an idiot and I'm an idiot, but she's slightly more of an idiot because, you know, I'm an idiot, but I'm grounded and she lets her fantasies get away with her.
Yeah, it's a shame because it feels like, why not just try? Why not do another comedy? And it feels like another. He does occasionally make these attempts to go, I'm going to do a comedy like he used to do, and then when he does it, they're always a bit okay, but they're not. It's like he can't do it. It's like he can't sort of commit to the idea of just making like a.
I think he probably thinks it's a waste of time because he's already done some comedies. I've already done some comedies. Oh, you want to see me do a comedy? Go back and watch. You know.
Oh sure. I mean, I don't mean you can't change, I suppose.
But I do like his early comedies. So I like Bananas, I like Love and Death in particular, I like Sleeper, and then Annie Hall I love. Never liked Manhattan, you can tell it's creepy, even back then, and also it's in black and white and I didn't like. I quite like Deconstructing Harry, which is in the 90s, but when he does his Ingmar Bergman stuff in the 80s, it's a bit like...
I think I can only really take about... It is, like, they are really bitty, his films, like you were saying. Like, I think there's, like, half an hour of Hannah and Her Sisters, which is funny. And the rest of it I really don't like. And that's meant to be one of the ones where people go, oh, that's one of his, like, proper good ones. And you go, I only really like half an hour of it.
Yeah.
Then they are really bitty. Like, they've got, like... It's like he does A plots and B plots, but they don't really interconnect, even. They're just, like, kind of two films that are going... It's like, well, I like that bit of it, but I don't like the other...
But also, Melinda and Melinda, that film, I when did I see that? I did the stand in Edinburgh, and I went back to the hotel, and they only had four channels, and Melinda and Melinda was on channel four, and I switched it on, and basically it was the only thing other than the news that was on, and I just had to read instead. I just hate that film so much, it drove me to books. Just awful, just fucking, but like awful in the way that it just makes you fucking. But then there's bits in Deconstructing. I mean, that is a bitty film, but that's an anthology film. But there's bits in Deconstructing Harry that I think really stand out, that are really great, and there are bits that don't work so well. But I mean, you get that with anthology films anyway. I don't know. I think I've always felt like this about his films, though. There are films that I think I think Annie Hall is just genuinely one of the greatest films, and then there are films where you just say, "Oh fuck off, Jesus Christ!" But that's the work of an artist, isn't it? I'm constantly going around the National Portrait Gallery,
telling
some of the paintings to fuck off.
Yeah, good for you.
In the very next room, I'm loving a Rembrandt, which isn't a euphemism before you, right? And oh, you haven't. Right, so we got up to Small Town Crooks. Bridget Jones's Diary.
That's when it
that.
Switched, didn't it? Because it's like they've gone, well, Hugh Grant, when you see him interviewed, he's much more of a sort of cheeky sort of...
Well, he plays a bad guy in Small Town Crooks.
Oh, okay.
A real shit in that. But then Bridget Jones's Diary is kind of like... But I don't think many people outside of Woody Allen's immediate fanship probably went to see that. Then you got Bridget Jones' Diary. Yeah, that's when he
came. And you do feel like maybe that's slightly closer to who he is in real life, and I get the impression he kind of relishes it.
This is a really weird kind of like, so God, so he did what? This timeline is kind of like not what I was expecting. Bridget Jones' Diary. Then he went back and did 2 weeks' Notice. And then About a Boy came around after that. I was thinking about a Boy... earlier today, maybe. It's weird that you've brought this up.
I watched it. I watched it the other day. Really like it still. Holds up.
It's really good. Based on a good book as well, though. And then you got Love Actually. I think that is just awful. I mean, I'm not like breaking the mould here, but I mean, that is a film that at the time it just set my teeth on edge. I hated that film.
I have a real mixed thing with Richard Curtis films, and it feels like, and I think the reason why I dislike some of them is because I almost It's because some of them are really good, and it's like you can always see how there's a really good film in all of them. It's like there's a really good film in this, and I find it frustrating that I think it's almost so close to being a really great film that when it isn't, I find it more disappointing.
I don't agree. I really like Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Me too.
I haven't seen a lot of his later films, but I did. I mean, I really love Four Weddings and a Funeral. Don't really get on with Notting Hill. I think the Julia Roberts character is despicable. I don't think she's likeable on any level, and you can't really follow her internal logic. It's kind of like he's explaining what's happened, and she's still angry with him, and it's kind of like, you know, I think
I sort of struggle with all of them. I think really, except for Four Weddings. I think that's the
Love Actually is the boat that rocks.
Mm. Oh yeah.
Bridget Jones, Edge of Reason. That's a disappointing sequel. I love the first Bridget Jones very much. Housewarming. I don't know what that is.
I don't know.
Then you got American Dreams in 2006.
Yeah. I saw that recently, and it is extraordinary.
Absolutely
film.
Insane, isn't it?
Absolutely insane.
Fucking, I mean, just a crazy, crazy, crazy movie. Then are you adding some in? Why is it changing? You're adding stuff at the top. What are you doing?
Nothing.
Okay. It seems like it's okay. We've got to go back to the beginning. So he did 82 Privileged, 87 Maurice White Mischief, 88 Rowing with the Wind, The Left, White Worm, The Dawning, The Bengal.
Oh, is it Bitter Moon? I'm thinking of not. Oh, I tell you, Remains of the Day. That's an incredible film.
Remains of the Day.
I absolutely love Remains of the Day.
That's the one I get mixed up with Shadowlands.
Yes, this is Emma Thompson and Anthony Hopkins. God, it's good.
I mean, Shadowlands. Those two films. Anthony Hopkins. Oh, I was watching something with Anthony Hopkins. Oh, I started watching The Wolfman last night.
Oh, yeah. Mm. I really like The Wolfman.
So, underrated movie. Got to play a song.
Okay, yeah.
Music and lyrics. I love it.
Love it.
It's a bad film in places, but the songs are incredible.
Great.
Hugh Grant is really up for it. Drew Barrymore is... typical classic Drew Barrymore, so either you like it or you don't. And then the plot is so getting down to it, music and lyrics. Did you hear about the Morgans, 2 weeks notice, and the rewrite, and probably the proposal? Basically, the guy that makes these films, what's it called?
Mark Lawrence.
There's a really kind of like, they're all high concept comedies, mm-hmm. that kind of like don't ever live up to the concept. Where, specifically with 2 weeks notice, it's called 2 weeks notice. So what it is you've got an environmental lawyer and you've got the head of a big corporate conglomerate or whatever you call them, right? And and basically he hires Sandra Bullock to... she infiltrates this conglomerate and... And in your head, what you think is they meet, they kind of like argue a bit, and then she gives 2 weeks notice, and then he's got kind of 2 weeks to turn his life around so that she won't leave. I think that's kind of like the film that you would want to see. And then it ends with him like going, I'm sorry, I'll change my way. But none of that happens. He makes some sort of like token gesture, like opening up a park at the end or something like, whoa!
Spoiler!
So he makes some sort of like...
you save that.
But it's so convoluted what the plot is. It just goes everywhere, and it takes... I think she hands in 2 weeks notice about 15 minutes towards the end of the film, and you go, that's what the whole film should have. You've called it 2 weeks notice. You've got room for a 5-minute sequence where Sandra Bullock needs a shit on in a traffic jam, and so she has to use someone's caravan. There's a static home. Oh no, it's not a static home. It's a camper van type thing. And then they play the song "Taking Care of Business" while Sandra Bullock is running along the freeway, trying not to shit herself. And it's meant to be like this really, I don't know, what, a romantic moment. And then Hugh Grant is basically stood outside the toilet making small talk with this family.
I mean, it sounds good, doesn't it?
Well, Sandra Bullock is behind a tiny little wooden door shitting her brains out. And you go, oh, I love this movie. What a great fucking movie.
It's actually
the highlight of the movie for me. And it's the only bit I really remember. And all of his films are like that, I think. 2 weeks' Notice is like that. And then music and lyrics is kind of like almost, but it kind of doesn't quite. Hugh Grant is just up for it in music and lyrics, and so he really makes that film. Did you hear about the Morgans?
Not seen it.
He's miscast. It's not. He's not good in that film, and it's not a good film. And music and lyrics is like it's a two star. It's just like it's like a cookie cutter two star romantic comedy that is elevated by basically Hugh Grant being just up for it. It's kind of, it looks cheap. There's a bit when he does a gig in a theme park and they've managed to herd up like 10 extras. And it's kind of like, okay. It just looks so cheap, the whole thing. And they've obviously like filmed it at kind of Universal or somewhere where they could film in for free because they're the people that have produced it. And then what was the last one that they did? The rewrite. Again, it's kind of like you kind of know what the picture is, and then the guy, you know what the concept is, but then they kind of don't really go for it. Right, I'm going to play a song now, and then we will be back. Interesting that you're saying that Woody Allen films actually improve with age. Fine. It's weird. You might be one of the only people on the planet that actually feels that way. Okay.
My favourite most recent. Working backwards is how it works. If I do them in order, it happens to be exactly most recent going backwards.
No, you were just saying that... hang on. Nick and Helm. So you were just
it says your name.
Yeah,
Nick Helm.
So you were just saying that Woody Allen probably makes some of the worst films
in the modern era now
in history. Of yeah,
well, it's sort of remarkable, isn't it? That, we're just talking. You go, do you know what? One of the worst films I've ever seen is this, and three of us came up with three different movies that were all recent Woody Allen films.
Yeah,
and you go, yeah, there's some of my least favourite films I've ever seen. Recent Woody Allen films.
Yeah. And it's weird.
But I think that might be the same thing of someone where you go, I know he's made brilliant films. So maybe it's more frustrating that you go, I cannot believe this is out there and you've made this.
Maybe just, you know, spend more than a year on it in each.
Yeah, that's
film,
what I always think. Do 2 years. 2 years.
So which Hugh Grant films did you watch?
I watched About a Boy.
Yeah.
I watched The Rewrite.
Yeah.
And I watched Mickey Blue Eyes. Mickey Blue.
Is that it?
So far.
You watched three. And what have you got coming up?
I think I'm going to try and do Small Time Crooks.
Yeah.
I'm going to do...
I'd be interested to know what you think of that. Because yeah. I think the first half hour is the best... in terms of being consistently funny without any pretensions of doing anything other than being entertaining, it's
well, he was like really a weird that sort of mid 90s era Woody Allen. He did have like a bit of a resurgence. So he had what's the one where it's Samantha Morton and Sean Penn? What's that?
Sweet and Lowdown. Yeah.
Sweet and Lowdown was good, and I thought Bullets Over Broadway was good.
Mm. I liked Manhattan Murder Mysteries, and I really liked, which is late 80s, I liked Purple Rose of Cairo.
Yeah.
Which is really kind of sad.
Yeah. I think I'm going to try and do it.
There were some that I don't have. I mean, I've got, because I'm packing my stuff, or if I'm unpacking my stuff now. I've got Shadows and Fog. Oh, God. but I haven't ever seen Zelig, and everyone goes on about Zelig being great. It's kind of like Forrest Gump before Forrest Gump. But I don't know. Basically, it's my goal in life to watch every single film that's ever been made.
Good luck.
It's hard. They keep making them.
I know, they don't make it easy.
And I keep watching films I've already seen. So, like, I watched Naked Gun 33 and a third. At the weekend.
How's that?
It's not. It's weird because...
I reckon I saw the first two a lot, and I think I might have seen that once or twice.
I saw it at the cinema, and I was disappointed with it when I saw it at the cinema. But not like... I don't hate it. Mm. I'm so happy to see Leslie Nielsen and George Kennedy and Priscilla Presley and OJ. You could like OJ back then. But
as I was saying, he's very good in them. He's great in them. I remember not knowing OJ before.
I only knew when the thing happened. It was just like, what, the guy out of Naked Gun?
Me too. That's what I know him for.
But 33 and a third is kind of the first two. I think are classics. I used to think it was really close between them, but now I'm a bit older and wiser. Naked Gun is a stone cold classic. It's just one of the funniest, consistently funniest over the years films that I've ever seen. Like, it was as funny now as it was the first day I saw it. Naked Gun 2.5, it's just really nice to see the gang get back together, and you go, oh, I still really like it. But there are kind of like some weird reaction shots where people are kind of like, know that they're in a spoof film. And then... But it's still got a storyline of its own. And then you have Naked Gun 33 and a third, where they are literally spoofing scenes from movies. It's like a precursor to the epic movie films and the date movie films, where it opens with a parody of the... what's the Battleship Potemkin step sequence from when they do it in The Untouchables? So basically, it's like the so it opens with a spoof of that scene in The Untouchables, and then there's a spoof of that scene in Thelma and Louise, and then there's a spoof of that scene from all the Prison Break movies, and then there's a spoof, and you go, and it basically feels like they've then there's a spoof of Beavis and Butthead, and then there's, and you go. they've basically taken a string of all these pop culture things, of stuff that's kind of like, even slightly out of date back then. I remember it's like the Untouchables thing was just like, why are you spoofing that? The Untouchables was made before the first Naked Gun movie. But then Thelma and Louise was very much kind of like a couple of years old by that point, but like it was still contemporary. And it's kind of like, it was Pat Proft that directed that one. He didn't direct the other two. I think the first one's a classic. The second one is very close. And the third one is like by a long shot, just nowhere near.
Yeah.
And I think it's specifically because it feels more like a modern spoof than it did like one of the classic Zucker Abraham Zucker films.
I think that's it. I guess in between, I guess you've got all the hot shots and things, haven't you? Which I guess are more spoof.
I think that you can get away with. Oh, God, you met her.
Yeah. To Valeria Galina. I did, yeah.
So gutted. I was ill.
Very nice, no?
Yeah. Very nice. And you got a photo of her with the
thumbs up.
I'm very jealous.
You wouldn't have liked it. You would have been coughing all over.
I know, exactly. That's the thing. It's kind of like I was ill and I was sneezing and coughing, and it's kind of like I would like to meet her, but not like that.
Not like this.
But yeah, and I think that spoof kind of like style worked in the Hot Shots films. I've never liked the first Hot Shots, but something about the second Hot Shots, which is I don't like Top Gun, so maybe it's that. I find Top Gun incredibly boring.
Me and my friends still say to each other, "I love you" in Wall Street.
it's like
a thing we say as we.
Well, that's what I watched last night. I watched Hearts of Darkness.
Oh yeah.
Which is it's the feature-length documentary before that was really a thing of the making of Apocalypse Now, and it's got like everyone is interviewed in it, like Martin Sheen, Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas, John Milius. So it's kind of like I think I prefer it to Apocalypse Now. I think the making of Apocalypse Now is a more enjoyable.
I mean, it is great. It is great.
Film than Apocalypse Now.
I just think it's. I mean, it's mad that they all went through that, and they almost shouldn't have. That's what you think about.
You shouldn't have done this.
You should have gone home.
But then he's like going. They're going. Don't you ever feel like quitting? He goes. What am I going to do? Quit myself? I'm putting up the money. This is my Francis Ford Coppola, who looks so much like David Trent in it. when we did Heavy Entertainment, I did a war episode, and we dressed him up like Francis Ford Coppola. And yeah, I mean, he's like saying that he put all of his own money in, so he couldn't walk away from the project. And he's just like,
the initial idea for. Apocalypse Now was they were filming it with all this sort of great sort of at the time sort of Lucas had given him all the top kind of cameras and sound things, and it was going to be this sort of cinematic sort of massive sort of experience.
John Milius wrote it for 16mm, and George Lucas was going to direct it, and Francis Ford Coppola was going to produce it. That's how it was.
And they got to the point where they wanted to have it almost like IMAX is now. Boy, they're going to show it in one movie theatre forever, essentially. and have it like this thing where it's got super, super duper sound. So almost like it was just going to be this place. You couldn't see it in other theatres. You could only see it in this one sort of movie theatre that had all the super up-to-date sound and sort of projection. It was this sort of weird idea they had as they were making it. Like, yeah, you can only ever see it there. And you'd have to go to this place to watch it. And it would just be in this one location.
That's weird, because they did that years later with Captain EO.
Yeah, they did.
The Michael Jackson movie, produced and written by George Lucas and directed by Francis Ford Coppola, starring Michael Jackson. And you could only go to Disneyland to watch it.
I think it's weird.
I saw it. Did you see it at Disneyland?
Mm.
Have you been to Disneyland?
Yeah, I went when I was 14. Worst age to go.
Because you're too cool for school.
Yeah, like generally, I'd love it now, and I'd have loved it before that. It's almost like, what a waste.
Yeah.
Like, it's just at a time when you see someone dressed as Minnie Mouse, and you go, oh, God, how embarrassing. And you just think, imagine it now. I don't know how much I'd give to see someone who's dressed like Minnie Mouse. Now I'd be like, brilliant.
I can
someone dressed
that.
As Goofy.
I can arrange that.
Yeah. choking on hot tea.
Yeah, but why are you saying? Why are you narrating what's happening now that I've swallowed the tea? when I can...
Because it's funnier. The silence is the what makes it funny.
I've been meaning to write a review of this for ages. A fantastic show. That's all about what? Thanks. That's the fan club. We've never said that. Mark Granger.
It's all about celebrating the things we love.
I've been meaning to write. Wrong use of the word write there. Wrong spelling of the word write. I've been meaning to write a review of this for ages. A fantastic show. It's all about celebrating the things we love. Not destroying the things we hate.
to quote
my favourite film, The Last Jedi.
Nice review.
And relax, by Tadak, if that is your real name. I was lured to this show as I adore Nick. What a great review. What a great review. I was lured to Lure this it. Show as I adore Nick. And now Nathaniel, a 5-star show with warmth, chemistry and Claudio Simonetti.
I haven't mentioned him for 3 weeks.
No. What's your favourite film?
Ever?
Yeah.
It's a Wonderful Life. What's your favourite film?
Mamma Mia! I believe that's correct pronunciation. The third film I said just before I ask you a question and then we get our guest on. The third film I saw was Expendables 3.
Okay.
Now, I remembered very much liking Expendables 3. I did not like Expendables 1.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost like it was custom built for me, but I thought it was an exercise in schedule clearing rather than filmmaking. I thought Expendables...
Great production manager on that film.
Expendables 1 was terrible. But interestingly enough, what's better than Expendables 1 is Inferno, the making of The Expendables, yeah. Which is a feature-length documentary about the making of Expendables, and it is absolutely fucking incredible.
It's the heart of darkness of The Expendables.
No, but it is. From a filmmaking point of view, you just watch the documentary, and what they went through to actually... Well, what Stallone went through in order to actually get Expendables made... He breaks his neck at one point. He breaks a bone in his neck when he's fighting Stone Cold Steve Austin. And they say, right, well, you can either halt the production of the film for 3 months while your neck heals, or just take these drugs and keep going. And so he just basically...
Course he had to, because you'll never get the people back.
You'll never get Dolph Lundgren and Jason Statham in a room together again. You'll never, right? What's Terry Crews going to do? And then Expendables 2 was slightly better, but the tone is all over the place. The tone veers from like very dark and not really gritty but dark stuff to just being like a spoof and everyone turning up in an airport at the end and just doing one-liners almost directly to the camera. And then the third one I thought was like a good balance between the two, where else are you going to see a film where Arnold Schwarzenegger, Harrison Ford, Sylvester Stallone, Dolph Lundgren, Terry Crews, Jet Li, Jason Statham all team up to kill Mel Gibson? I mean, what a movie. It's just like, you know, well, who haven't we used yet? Well, in the second one, it was like, who haven't we used yet? Well, Jean-Claude Van Damme, all right, but we'll make him the bad guy. And it's like, who haven't we used yet now? Well, Mel Gibson. And what's good about the use of Mel Gibson is the fact that he, all the way through the Lethal Weapon movies, there are all these Three Stooges references. And in Expendables 3, there are all these Three Stooges references because they go, well, what's Mel Gibson famous for? Well, aside from the obvious, it's the Three Stooges references. And so they throw that in there. And it's just interesting, I just think. But it's like, well, we can't make him a good guy, but we haven't used Mel Gibson, so we'll make him a bad guy, and we'll all go and kill Mel Gibson. And that is the plot of Expendables 3. I saw it at the London premiere, and all the cast came out.
Oh, yeah.
And I was so happy. I had to go down the red carpet really quickly, because that was the only way in, not because I was a guest. And... we walked past Wesley Snipes, Jason Statham, Antonio Banderas, and then I don't think Stallone was around. Probably doing interviews. backstage. And we went and sat on the front row, and Antonio Banderas came out and he did a little poem. And you go, oh, Antonio Banderas steals that film. He's so good. But Expendables 3, the best of the Expendables films, but still not good. Okay, so here's a quick question. Who provides the voice of the mother in The Incredibles?
Holly Hunter.
Of course it is. Now we're going to play a song.
David Bowie in The Heat of the Morning, is it?
Yeah, that's right. It's David Bowie in The Heat of the Morning. We don't normally introduce them, though. No.
Fubar Radio.
Is it guest two? Is it guest two? Is it guest two? Yes, guest two. So I was just trying to work out which microphone to put back on. There's that bit in Wayne's World 2 where they're waiting for Handsome Dan to come out, and then the guy that goes in and introduces himself was Mr. Charming from next door in Married with Children. And then they realise that he's actually just screaming Dan. And when Handsome Dan comes out, it's Harry Shearer, and he's really short and sweaty, and he's wearing like a tracksuit. And that, I just saw a reflection of myself as I went past the mirror, and I was like, "Oh no, that's what I look like. I've moved in house, and I don't have any clothes. I can't find my clothes that I've unpacked." And I had a photo shoot today where I had sweaty hair, and I look awful. Anyway, I'm apologising. I'm ashamed to be alive. Anyway, we're joined in the studio now by actor,
Yeah.
Actor, sure. Tom Goodman Hill.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm really good, thanks. I've got a, well...
I was going to say, you're coming injured.
I had an altercation with my cat.
Yes. So I saw you when we did our photo, and I did that thing where I noticed it straight away, and then I was like, I'm not going to mention it. And yeah. I just thought, it's weird that I haven't mentioned
yeah,
it.
Yeah, you thought, maybe he's had surgery or something. Maybe it's something I shouldn't
maybe
talk about.
Maybe he doesn't
about.
Know.
Maybe I don't know. Maybe I have no idea. There's a scar right across the bridge
really
of my nose.
I mean, it really is. It's pretty gumpy.
What happened?
No, she didn't go for me. We've just had a baby. And if you ever, when you've got a 3-week-old baby in the house, your cats get really jealous and they get really, really needy. And they also piss in the cot, which is a really nice thing to do.
Oh,
so she pissed in the cot. So I'm running downstairs with the mattress into the kitchen. And she doesn't know she's done anything wrong because you can't tell them off, otherwise it all gets worse. And so she's all around my feet. And I sort of didn't notice her. And tripped over her and smacked my nose on the kitchen counter.
Oh, I thought the cat...
No, she didn't attack me. Although she, you know, she can be known to do that.
Don't cats do stuff like piss on your pillows as well?
Maybe your cat.
I don't have a cat. I'm allergic to cats and all their behaviour. I'm not a fan.
No, they've never done that. Never done that. In fact, they've never done sort of anything like it before. So... I don't know.
Oh, no, it was Johnny, I think Johnny Sweet, when he said that he had a cat and it used to shit on his pillows.
Shit on his pillows.
So when you get in, wow, I mean, they know that's where you put your head.
Yeah.
And when you get in, you go, you've got shit all over your pillows. And it's just like, oh, fuck. And it's when they're really angry, your pets are really angry with you. They go, how can I fuck? Right, I'm going to shit where they sleep.
But imagine if that was a human, you'd never forgive them. If it was a human being, you'd be like, no, not acceptable.
And you wouldn't really know how to cope with it. Wouldn't you say to someone who's just
shat on your pillow? I don't know.
I just think never shit where you sleep. All right, Natalie? So we're going to... So you two used to be neighbours.
Yeah.
We did.
Upstairs, downstairs neighbours.
Are you still there?
No, we've moved.
Okay.
Yeah, we had Nat and also Angela Barnes.
Yes.
Upstairs.
What?
Yeah.
What?
And Angela,
were you living in Stella Street?
Yeah, exactly. And Angela used to run the youth theatre that my son went to.
Hang on, where was this?
This is in Gypsy Hill.
Oh.
Yeah.
Was that afterwards then?
Yeah, when she, it was the South...
North, oh, South
the
London Theatre.
The South London Theatre.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
And she ran a youth theatre that my kids went to. Yeah.
How long ago was this?
So...
I moved out 4 years ago.
Years ago, yeah. So it was 5 and 4 years ago.
So, because Angela Barnes used to live in Brighton.
Yeah.
And she used to run a gig at...
Funny Farm.
The Farm. Was it just called The Farm Pub? And then they called it The Funny Farm. That would make sense. yeah, that's how I knew Angela. But I felt like I think she's moved back to Brighton. Not that it's anyone's business, but she moved back down to Brighton. But
she's got a gig tonight, Leicester Square Theatre.
Fucking hell, I bet she regrets that move now.
It'd be much easier to get home, wouldn't it? Yeah. From,
well, I've regretted my move. I mean, I used to live, I don't know if you knew this, but I used to live just 5 minutes round the corner. And now I've just moved the other side of Holloway Road.
About 10 minutes away.
Unbelievable. Well, it's a bit of a nightmare because Nat insists that we meet at Starbucks. So I actually have to walk 11 minutes and then double back on that last minute to get here.
That's unacceptable.
And that is a bore leg. It takes Nat slightly longer to get across town.
About 45 minutes.
But it's really upped the
feel the pain.
Level
tough,
of travel
stuff
that I've had to do.
I used to live with my ex-girlfriend in above you.
Yeah.
And right. I remember there being a thing where I remember
in
coming
Gypsy Hill.
Gypsy Hill.
What's in Gypsy Hill? What's Gypsy Hill near?
It's between
Crystal Palace
and West Norwood.
And what's West Norwood?
So West Norwood's just south of Brixton.
Brixton.
So, you know.
That way.
You're going that way.
Sure.
And I remember there being a thing where I remember bumping into you and it was quite a grim time, because I remember that I was just collecting some of my stuff from the flat and you saying, oh, I think there might be a bit of a leak or something. And I was saying, oh, okay. Oh, right. I'll let them know. And then said, oh, I don't... Because you hadn't realised.
I said,
I don't live here anymore. Me and Anne split up. And you were kind of very... Oh, yeah, left it.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, but shall I... shall I tell them? And you're like, no, it's okay. I think there's something so English about it. And then didn't actually leak through or something.
I don't know what happened. Some sort of condensation weirdness was going on.
And then, so was there three flats in one house?
No, it was... two. So I was living with Anna and Angela Barnes was our flatmate.
I never knew you lived with Angela Barnes.
Sorry, well, it wasn't a secret.
You're a bit of a dark horse, aren't you? No, because we literally just talk about films, though, don't we?
Yeah,
we do. I think that's our relationship, isn't it?
I think it is.
I think that, it's escapism. Yeah, but it is weird that, I've known you for 12 years and I went to see your gig and I went and stood outside after the gig and I stood next to a chap who was smoking and I said, Nat was very good, wasn't he? He goes, yes, I'm his brother. I was like, oh, nice to meet you. Didn't know he had a brother. Didn't mention.
Maybe you should just listen to each other more. Right?
No, I. But that's terrible for radio, because when I stop talking, you stare at me.
we were playing a David Bowie track,
yeah,
and I did notice that you'd put David Bowie as something that
I did,
a fan of.
Yeah.
And David Byrne.
David Bowie and David Byrne. I put them as one thing because I was obsessed with both of them for as long as I can remember.
Now, David Byrne is the one from
Talking
Dead
Heads.
Or Alive. No, right. That's Pete Burns, right? That's Pete Burns, right? No, Talking Heads, right?
Yeah.
I think Talking Heads are a band, although Nick might dispute this from that. I think Talking Heads are a band.
I absolutely think they are a band.
They were a band.
That everyone loves?
God, I hope so. That would be a nice thing.
I think they're almost their hit rate, I think, amongst people is almost universally positive. I don't think I meet people that know Talking Heads and go, I don't like it.
Oh, yeah, no, if they know them, they love them. There's loads of people who just didn't know them, never got into them. But so, I think if you know them, you love them.
So do Talking Heads... Talking Heads did the Stop Making Sense tour.
Yeah.
And that's also known as the Big White Suit tour.
Yeah.
So I've got that on DVD. I think that's excellent.
Yeah.
Now, do Talking Heads do a song on the soundtrack to The Breakfast Club?
Do Talking Heads?
Is that Simple Minds?
Simple Minds.
See, I get Talking Heads and Simple Minds.
Really?
I can see that. By name confused. Sure. Not by music.
Sure.
So David Byrne sang Psycho Killer.
Yeah, he did.
And he also sang Lazy.
He did.
Oh, I'm wicked and I'm lazy.
That's the one.
Oh, don't you want to change me?
Yeah,
that's the one. Yes.
Lazy in the morning. Lazy.
That one.
Yeah. I didn't like that.
Well, David Bowie and David Byrne are two artists who have like a slightly ethereal quality about them, right?
Sure, but it does make me think that you didn't get beyond the bees in the David section.
No, that's not fair. No,
David Baddiel? What do you think?
David Baddiel, he never did any good songs.
Okay.
Three lines in the show,
three lines! I'll forget three lines. But they were both sort of art school guys who were obsessed with film as well and all that kind of stuff. So they were both into the same kind of things that I was into, and so I just crazily worshipped them and wanted to be them and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I loved David Byrne made a Talking Heads movie called True Stories in the 80s.
He did. I watched a documentary about that the other week. It's weird though, right?
Yeah, it's completely weird. It's a little bit kind of David Lynch. But it's and it's just a sort of small town set of stories and all the people who live in the town. And then they had an album called True Stories, which was a Talking Heads album that that is all related to the film. John Goodman's in the film and all sorts of people. It's a fun kind of
was 80s it late
movie.
80s?
86, I think. Yeah.
It's weird. It's weird how these things come up, because I literally saw a documentary about that like 2 weeks ago.
I saw David Byrne walking through Soho once, and even though living in London, you're not... You see people all the time, don't you? And it doesn't... You sort of become quite blasé about it. And I did a real kind of... You just want to point at people and go, look, it's David Byrne. So I couldn't believe it. It's one of those people that I just never would expect to see in real life. I guess, just people that have got a sort of quality about them where the idea that they still exist in your world is slightly not...
Was he kind of wearing normal clothes?
He was wearing either like a very sort of light or white suit.
Yeah, he does that all the time. Yeah. He'll walk around in an all-white kind of jogging suit, like white hoodie, white kind of quite tailored jogging pants and white sneakers, and his hair's white. So he kind of...
Yeah.
It's a really... Kind of
so I guess it doesn't really blend in. He's gone for really blend
it.
In.
He's gone for it, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, why should he? It's David Byrne.
Yeah, he doesn't.
No, of course.
I tell you what, I walked past. I tell you, you'll never guess. You'll never guess who I walked past yesterday.
I don't know. Well, I won't guess.
Well, give a guess.
No, you said I never will.
Well, both of you guess.
Kate Bush.
No.
Sooty.
No. You get three guesses each.
Natalie from FUBAR Radio.
No.
Boris Johnson.
No.
Last guess. I better make this good. James Bond.
No. Nigel Kennedy, the violinist.
No. It was the grown-up kid from Son of Rambo.
Okay.
Who plays Which the kid? British Prime Minister in Love Actually?
No idea.
It's Hugh Grant.
And he did a really good... I was listening to you talking about his movies. There's one movie he did where he plays it straight called Extreme Measures, him and Gene Hackman.
Yeah. It's we mentioned that earlier.
Oh, you did?
We did mention it
before
earlier.
Before I arrived when I was on the way.
But I haven't seen it, but go on.
It's really good.
It's really good.
He plays it straight. It's ludicrous, but it's really good.
I think it is a good one. But there was also a film of almost the same time called Desperate Measures, starring Andy Garcia and Michael Keaton. As kind of like... Michael Keaton was this bodybuilding Hannibal Lecter type who wears glasses. That's a kind of a cool action-type film. I don't know. I like the 90s. They made loads of good films in the 90s.
I think
it was like action films just aren't as good. And not like I only like action films, but romantic comedies. I think Sleepless in Seattle was the last decent romantic comedy ever made. And then, you look at The Rock and you compare The Rock to Skyscraper starring The Rock. You just think, stick to just being the title of a movie. You don't have to be in them.
So Tom, you are here.
It's a bit of a weird one.
Promoting your new series.
Oh, yeah.
Which is Cheat.
Which is called Cheat, which starts on Monday, straight through to Thursday at 9 p.m. on ITV1.
And what's that about?
It's about a university lecturer. So it's Kate Kelly playing a university lecturer, and I'm her husband, also a university lecturer, so straightforward. But she has a student played by the amazing Molly Windsor, who won the BAFTA last year, who is kind of obsessed with her, and we don't really know why. And Kate's character accuses her of plagiarism in one of her sort of final papers for her degree, and fails her. And then the whole kind of thing kicks off from there, because Molly's character Rose just won't take it, and is kind of obsessed with sort of revenge, but then you're not sure if she is or if it's all inside Kate.
And you don't know
Kate's
whether she has cheated or not.
She has cheated or not cheated, and so the whole thing starts to kick off. And
that's
I'm supposed
really
to be
premise.
The voice of reason in the middle, but in fact I'm a tremendously flawed character who really can't work out what's going on. So it's a lot of fun, but it's kind of like a psychological mystery / horror.
Okay.
Yeah.
It sounds almost, although I don't know if it will end up being, almost like those sort of urban thrillers of your sort of Pacific Heights and
Hand That Rocks the Cradle.
Yeah, Rocks the Cradle.
I've got no problem with that.
Okay. Malice.
Is that fair?
Exactly.
Or is it similar?
Hand That Rocks the Cradle's not a bad comparison.
That was my one.
Single
white female, not a bad comparison.
Right. Got it.
Not a good comparison, but...
Juice Bigelow, European Gigolo.
Anything like that?
No.
Not really.
No, not on this occasion.
Okay, that's all right.
No, but it sounds like it, yeah, I don't know. It's a very smart premise. You're actually in a TV drama a few years ago, which I don't think a lot of people gave it the credit to do, and that was The Devil's Whore.
Absolutely
loved it.
It probably is my favourite job of all time. Yeah.
Just for being in, or
for being in, for doing it, and everything. Because I played John Lilburn, who was the leader of the Levellers, who I'm distantly related to.
Really?
Which is by a weird coincidence.
So it wasn't something that you knew about at the time, or was it in your research?
I did know about it, but I didn't walk into the audition and go, "I'm related to this man. I will play him."
I've done that once.
But have you? Well done.
Well, I auditioned. I wasn't related to them, but I lived three doors down from Toby Jones. Uh-huh. And I mentioned in the audition that I get his post sometimes. And in the back of my head, I thought, they'll save a bit of money on cars.
Did you get it?
No. So I don't know. So The Devil's Whore. I don't know this.
It was a sort of Civil War drama. Civil War.
Yeah.
Well, and it was a sort of...
Let's let Tom explain
it. Yeah, you should.
Yeah, it was set in the Civil War. So it's all about...
Hang on a minute. Sorry, Tom. But I cannot believe that we've got the actual... One of the stars of that show. Was it a show?
It was a show.
Yeah. In the room. All right, and
no, you're right.
And you're going about explaining to him, while he's in here, what the plot of his own work is, when we could just ask him to explain it.
Yeah. No, that's fair. That is fair.
So you may actually,
sorry, Tom, carry on.
Nat, to be fair, may remember it better than I do. But it's English Civil War. So it's about Cromwell and King Charles. And
so when you say you relate to the Levellers, you didn't mean the band?
I didn't mean the band.
Because I assumed that The Devil's Horn was a historical piece. And then you said the Levellers, and I thought, maybe it's about the band.
Because the band are named after the movement.
What? So tell me about this movement. Was it
the Levellers?
So back in the day, the land was quite hilly.
But it's not that. It's about it's about leveling class. So they were sort of proto communist, except well, not really, but they were certainly proto socialists. And so Lilburn was a socialist at a time when it wasn't fashionable to be a socialist. So
hang on, I'm going to stop you there, Tom. Sorry, now, what was it about?
Well, one of the things I thought was quite neat about it has it. So you have all these characters, some that are real and some are fictional.
Yeah.
But you have John Sims' character, who's essentially, doing a kind of Yojimbo man with no name type character.
Although
that comes
he's
in.
Based on a real guy.
I assumed he was a fictional character.
No, Sexby was real. The only major character who isn't real is the star of it, which is Andrea Riseborough, who was playing Angelica Fanshawe. She never existed. So the main
was she the Devil's Whore?
And she's the Devil's Whore.
Yeah. She's brilliant, isn't she?
She's amazing,
absolutely fantastic in everything.
Yeah.
But in that, it's that to another sort of man with no name, Yojimbo, man goes into a town. It's this English Civil War, but plays off the two sides against...
Sorcerers and the wizard, the dragon.
Mostly.
What's the one with David Carradine?
It's real, isn't it? Which one? Oh, the I know what you mean.
I watched it the other week. The Warlock and the Sorcerer. It's just basically, it's a film. It's a sword and sorcery film, and it started, and I was like, oh, this will be great. And then within seconds, you just know it's a rip-off of Yojimbo, and you go, oh, and then you've got to sit through the same story beats again for, like, the millionth time. Anyway, sorry, but I just need to get that off my chest. I can't remember the name. Can you look up the name of the David Carradine film that rips off Yojimbo?
But it is. It's in that. And I thought, what a really smart
But when
way
I say
doing.
That, yeah. when I say, oh, no, you've got to sit through the same story beats again, I have to say, The Devil's Horse sounds excellent.
It really is excellent.
Just realise what I've done there. Some retake, The Warrior and the Sorcerers.
Is that what it is? I've never heard of that one.
No, I haven't.
Oh, yeah. You'd have seen, if you're not familiar with it, basically I was going to write a show about barbarianism, and I bought Conan. I went on Amazon and I bought all these films that I've actually got on... downloaded on my TV already. It was a waste of money. I bought Red Sonja twice. Ooh, I clicked on it twice on Amazon, and so I've got two copies.
Will it
sell
it to you twice?
Yeah, it's got a two, but you didn't realise until you bought it. I quite like Red Sonja.
Oh, not that much.
Not to own. Well, I've got an upstairs and a downstairs. I've always got it playing. I've got Sonja playing upstairs.
I heard a rumour once, and I really want it to be true, that Shane Ritchie is such a big fan of the Planet of the Apes
I
films.
Told you this.
Oh, did you?
Yes.
That he has Planet of the Apes playing in his toilet 24/7.
No, he doesn't.
Yes, it projects.
Really,
he has
it starts playing, I think, when the lift goes down or when he shuts the door, and then a screen comes down and it picks up from where he left off. And it's on loop.
That's good. The good way of watching it. So he's never going to miss. It's not going to be the opening always the opening like 5 or 10 minutes every time.
No, exactly.
Good, that's smart.
I think, yeah, I really do think that Shane Ritchie loves Planet of the Apes.
I
do. Of course, if it was my toilet, it would be Escape from Planet of the Apes, which is the third and best of all of the Planet of the Apes movies.
I think you're right. It's my favourite one.
Really?
Yeah, Escape from Planet of the Apes is...
Escape from Planet of the Apes is the one where they go back in time.
To the 1970s.
So there's lots of apes walking
right,
about.
Yeah.
And
okay.
Yeah. Run along, Zira, don't dawdle. That's my Roddy McDowell impression. Really committed to that. But hang on, you keep getting distracted. Tell us about the Devil's Horn.
More about the Devil's Horn.
Well, was it written by Peter Flannery?
It was written by Peter Flannery.
And he
yes.
did Our Friends in the North.
Our Friends in the North.
Which, again, is one of the best. Probably one
TV
of the best
but started
TV
off
shows.
It started off as a play.
Okay.
Which I saw as a kid.
Oh, really?
Because the Royal Shakespeare Company did it. And it was a commission for the Royal Shakespeare Company, so he wrote it as a play. And when I was about 12 or 13 years old, I saw it in Newcastle, where I grew up.
Oh, wow.
Twice.
In fact,
and
I think,
it became
did I
a
know?
TV series, yeah.
And does the play not go up to... Where does that leave off? That goes up to what era?
No, the play is as long as the series.
Oh,
so
wow.
You watched it in three parts. I think it was a huge, epic three-part play. So you'd spend the whole day watching the play.
God, I love that.
Yeah.
What a great series.
Yeah.
And he doesn't seem to... I mean, he's someone I always try
enough.
And... Yeah, it
yeah.
just feels like...
I know.
Every time I look at it, it feels like, well, what's he? What else he done?
Excuse
and you
me.
Realise when he's
This is going to make me sound really unprofessional. But
what's Our Friends in the North about?
Oh, well, yeah, that's what you're talking about. Was it Our Friends in the North?
Yeah.
Right, sorry, I missed that vital piece of information because Natalie just messaged us some Shane Ritchie knowledge. So just for the fans at home, news just in. Shane Ritchie, this is a direct quote from Shane Ritchie. You know, I've got the original Planet of the Apes wagon, don't you? Mate, I've got the original wagon they threw Charlton Heston into. I got that when I was doing eBay while drinking Jack Daniels. That was a lost weekend. It cost him £9,000 to buy the original wagon from the 1968 film Planet of the Apes. Having bought it, Ritchie spent another £12,000 to get the memorabilia shipped over to England from the US. So that ended up costing him a whopping £21,000.
Anyway, could you get Shane Ritchie on, please? Make a note. Let's see if we can get Shane Ritchie on while we talk about his Planet of the Apes wagon.
My ex-girlfriend, who really fancied me, also fancied.
That's good.
She also fancied Shane Ritchie, Frank Spencer, not Michael Crawford, Frank Spencer, and Joe Pasquale. Not so much a compliment now, is it? Let's say best of a bad bunch, but don't even believe that anymore. Anyway, Our Friends in the North. Tell us about that again.
Well, you weren't in that.
No,
but
I wasn't in
now.
I wasn't in that, but that's where we're on now.
But Peter Flannery.
And David Morrissey wasn't in that.
No,
he
wasn't.
Oh. You think he was, but he wasn't.
Yeah, well, my mum thinks he was, is the thing.
Are you thinking of...
There was Daniel
Blackpool
Craig.
Or something like that.
No, I'm specifically thinking of Our Friends in the North because I went to see David Morrissey in 3 Days of Rain with Colin Firth. And I was just sweating.
We're now, we've moved away so far from things
so
you are in.
Literally.
Yeah, but you may
I've
have
lost
seen them.
There. Yeah, no. Our Friends of the North was Daniel Craig, Mark Strong.
Gina McKee.
And
maybe it was Mark Strong.
Christopher Eccleston,
yeah.
I don't think it was Christopher Eccleston.
He was in Three Days of Rain.
Who was in 3 Days of Rain? Was it... With Colin Firth.
Yeah, but we're talking about two different things. They could both be in their own...
No, but... I think David Morrissey was in 3 Days of Rain, the play.
Yes.
And at the Donmar Warehouse. And at the time, my mum was convinced that he was also in Our Friends in the North.
I think your mum's made an error.
I think she has.
Unless he was in a more minor character.
Maybe he was in a smaller role.
Wasn't he one of the... He was the bad guy.
Alan Armstrong was T-Dance.
Alan Armstrong in 3 Days of Rain.
Sorry.
James McAvoy would have been sperm when I went to see 3 Days of Rain.
He was in it though, wasn't he?
James McAvoy?
Yeah.
In 3 Days of Rain?
Yeah, but maybe later on. But
in
the original version that I saw. It sounded like you said Neil Morrissey.
David Morrissey,
sure.
Yeah, he was in 3 Days of Rain.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Was he in Our Friends in the North? It's weird, isn't it? Because he is northern. You'd think that if they were getting that group, he is part very much of the Eccleston.
Sure, I can see how you'd think he might be in Our Friends in the North.
But he wasn't Doctor Who either. He was in it, though. He was what was he?
He thought he was the Doctor.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, in an episode.
Yeah. You were in Doctor Who?
I was in Doctor Who.
And that's Bob's comedy connection. So,
yeah, he'd had the Doctor's personality put into him, hadn't he, somehow, via the watch thing.
Yes, I think so.
Something like that.
What I like is we're talking to you about lots of things that you haven't been in. Yeah. Well, you have parallel. It's like parallel
weird
careers.
Parallel.
Well, we wanted to ask you, right? We wanted to ask you a question.
Yeah.
You were in the movie, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
I was, yeah.
Now, that is the film that made Sean Connery retire from acting.
All acting.
What was that like?
It was amazing. Because he
So what character did you play in?
I played Sanderson Reed, who's not in the original graphic novel. Mm. In the original graphic novel, there's a character called Campion Bond, who brings the League together and is supposed to be James Bond's grandfather. Which is why they were so chuffed to get Connery in playing Quatermain.
Right.
But because in the movie they wanted that Campion Bond character to turn out to be a, spoiler, villain, they changed his name to Sanderson Reed and made him look nothing like Campion Bond. So I played that guy.
Right.
So, and Connery was amazing. I spent the first 2 weeks shooting almost exclusively just with him in the sort of Britannia Club setting, him and David Hemmings.
And you're one of the last people to be able to say that.
And I'm one of the last people to be able to say I shot a film with Sean Connery.
He did do the voiceover of that Scottish animated movie, Sir Willy.
He did.
That's an odd. That looks like an odd animation.
He did, but he just had enough.
Of acting in general, or
I think he got frustrated somehow and just thought, I don't need to be doing this
but
anymore.
But your experience of making it was great.
Was amazing. Had a brilliant time on it. And but Steve Norrington, who's a beautiful, lovely man who directed it. And Sean did not get on, to say the least. And so that was difficult.
Do you know what the thing was between them? What the
a combination of too many late lights and lots of just drugs, probably. I think it was just they were very allegedly they were they just sort of came to blows. They just didn't.
Sean
right
Connery right. Staying up all night.
No. I'm being silly. They were.
Have you heard it here first, thanks.
They just didn't see eye. They did not. They did not see eye to eye.
Nothing happened.
And there's no mystery. They didn't see eye to eye.
No.
Very vocal about.
No,
it.
I find that really interesting. Yeah. For instance, our friend Gemma Whelan was in the movie The Wolfman, and I really love The Wolfman.
I love it.
But the original director was what's his fucking name? He's a music video director. His surname begins with an R.
I used to know this.
Look it up, Natalie. No, it was. Oh, fuck it. I do know this, and it's gone. Anyway, so the original director. Are you looking it up? Are you looking it up, or are you having a chat? I know who the director was. Who was the original director? Who was the guy that was doing it before? Not Joe Johnston. He is the director. Anyway, there was a guy that was on it, and not George Wagner. It begins with an R. So the original guy that was on it, oh my God, it's so annoying because it comes off all the time. The original guy that was on it had been on it for like a year and a half, and then he quit 2 weeks before they started filming, and Joe Johnston basically came on and he had 2 weeks to basically prep and take over the entire production of this big period special effects movie. And and Gemma was kind of like on the entire shoot, and when you see the final film, she literally opens the door and says hello, and then Emily Blunt says, I need to see the man of the house, and then she lets her in, and that's it. And I like asked Gemma about it. I said, what happened there? And Gemma's like, I'm in every scene, but there's like a funeral scene where there's a carriage, and she goes, I'm in the carriage. You know, wow. She had to be there for the entire thing, but she's in like a blinking, you'll miss in part. And I just find that sort of thing fascinating.
There's a character in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Mark Romanek, that's it. Mark Romanek.
There's a character in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen who was like the MacGuffin that sort of went through the whole plot. She's the kidnapped daughter of a scientist who's building all those zeppelins at the beginning of the movie. and the League are put together to save her, and to get her back to her father, who's the who's killed, who's kidnapped at the beginning.
Yeah,
she's not in the film. She was the main plot device. She's not in the film. It's probably okay to say this 20 years later. She's not in the film, but there is one trailer that I think still exists where she's standing in a dress next to a toad. She's a beautiful actress called Winter Avezzoli, who's done really brilliant work since. And this was her first big break. And it just pans across a table, and there's this beautiful woman in a dress who's not in the film, just in that one trailer.
Right, yeah.
And she was completely cut out. They just cut out. It was about a 35-minute section of the film.
God, it's extraordinary.
The studio cut after Stephen left the picture and the whole production of it just changed in the edit. And she's not in it.
I do find that really fascinating.
Yeah, like
The original trailer for like Mission Impossible it hints at a romantic subplot with Tom Cruise and who's the woman in the first
Emmanuel Bett?
Right, yeah. Mm. And I think there's a scene where they kiss in the trailer, and it's not in the film. And then there's nothing happening. And you go, well, they've cut an entire plot. My girlfriend, she's a makeup artist, and she's like, what was work like today? She goes, oh, it's boring, just lots of standing around. What she fails to mention is that she did the reshoots on Rogue One and Han Solo, the Solo movie. And it's kind of like, so she did the reshoots for Rogue One with the Darth Vader hallway sequence where and you go, boring, lots of standing around. And then you got to work with Darth Vader. And then the other one was, she was basically, there were six Chewbaccas on the Solo movie, and they basically took a lot of hair makeup people to look after him. But like, you go, fucking hell, I find all of that fascinating. Like, what was Solo like? They filmed 98% of the film, and then they had 2 weeks left of filming, and then they replaced him with Ron Howard, and it's kind of Lord and Miller. They replaced Lord and Miller. I just find what might have been those alternate timelines.
Mm.
One of my favourite directors is Bruce Robinson, like With an Eye. How to Get Ahead and Advertising, which are brilliant films, but he then went on to make a film called Jennifer 8, which was a serial killer movie.
Yeah,
and
with Andy Garcia,
John Malkovich,
and
Uma Thurman.
Uma Thurman, and Jennifer. She plays a blind woman.
Yeah,
yeah.
And there's a massive story involving John Malkovich's FBI agent that's supposed to go all the way through. And it ended up being a 20-minute interrogation scene, and he's cut from the rest of the film because Bruce lost editorial control of the film. And so there's a cut out there somewhere of Bruce Robinson's like proper Jennifer 8, which we'll never see.
Are there different versions of The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen then?
There aren't. Everyone, like all the fans, go, I wish we could see Steve Norrington's director's cut, but you never will.
But it's like the Justice League as well, where Zack Snyder. Everyone wants to see the Snyder Cut. Yeah, it's not going to be any better than whatever we ended up with.
There's obviously more, though, isn't there? That's what you think. It's one of those films where you go, I mean, it's about 80 minutes, and it's like one of those kind of, there must be...
Well, they cut it down. It had to be cut down to 2 hours so they could show it. But you just like, but the tone is so inconsistent with Man of Steel and Dawn of Justice that you just think... At least just show... I mean, it might be another shit film, but at least just show us the shit film so it makes content. Just make another shit film that's got nothing to do with the other two films.
The premise of that film was they have to find five boxes or something, and you see at the start they get two of them, and they go get another two, and then there's another one which has been like referenced, and they go, oh, what about the other box? And it's like, oh yeah, I got that one as well. Yeah. And it's just like opens off screen. The whole premise of the thing is that you're looking for these boxes, and it's just like save a bit of time. They're like, I got that one as well. Just happened in a bit we didn't film. And then you go, it must have filmed this.
Then did you see the Michael Fassbender film The Snowman?
Yeah.
Where they didn't film the film. They filmed like 60% of the film and then had to release it. So basically the scenes where because when you look at it, there's like, I watched a thing about it, and when you watch the film, it starts off and there's lots of really complicated shots with you know, all the cameras are on rails and they're kind of like all moving for every single bit of dialogue, which takes ages to set up, and it's going from every angle and it's doing all this. And then later on, it's kind of like very static. And there's scenes where they go and investigate someone's house, and then they're driving away from the house, and then the plot is, hang on a minute, it's back at the house. We've got to turn around and go back to the house. But instead of showing the car turning around, they just do it as voiceover. It's this car driving away from the house and going, hang on a minute, the bad guy's still there. We better turn around. But they never show the footage of the car turning around. It's just Michael Fassbender doing ADR, like additional dialogue recording, doing ADR. They're just trying to save this film, and the ending doesn't make any sense, and it's just kind of like, and it's crazy. And you go, that's not like there's an alternative cut of that film.
They just don't have the footage.
They didn't have the footage in order to make the film that they set out to make.
They pulled the plug because it had gone way over budget. Is that right?
I think it went over schedule.
Ah, right. Okay.
And I think they had Michael Fassbender for, like, he was contracted to do like 3 months or however long it was.
He was in Devil's Hall.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Right.
He plays Thomas Rainsborough in Devil's Hall. It was about the last thing he did before he suddenly went stratospheric because Hunger came out that summer.
Right.
Yeah.
Hunger. I mean, you gotta watch it, Nick.
I will.
Great bit of
writing it down. Devil's Whore. I just want to say I've moved house and I haven't had the internet. So, well, then that changes because you saw The Devil's Whore ages ago, right?
Yeah.
When it came out. What's your favourite film?
My favourite film. It's always a toss up between. It's always either Blade Runner or Whitman and I, depending on what mood I'm in.
Which Blade Runner? There's five cuts.
Well, I would go Final Cut.
Final Cut, sure. Yeah.
Although it's not the one I fell in love with.
Which one was that? The one with the voiceover?
Yeah, whatever the first... Yeah, the one with the voiceover when it first came out on TV. First saw it on TV because I was a kid.
Yeah. How old are you?
50.
Oh. Younger than me.
You're not. You're not.
I'm 59.
Nick.
I don't know why he's doing.
Stop it.
I don't even know why.
Are you really 50?
I'm 50.
You look very good.
No, you're not.
50.
I am a 50.
I just assumed you were 30. How old am I? You didn't just tell that to the. Can I? Am I the only one that can listen? Am I the only one that can hear you?
Yes.
I'm IMDb age 26.
Nice.
Are you really 50?
I'm 50.
That's incredible.
Very good for 50.
That's incredible.
Yeah, ginger gene.
What's your secret?
It's just the ginger gene, pale skin. That's all it is.
I don't think it's paleness. That doesn't mean that you look younger.
I don't know, probably just stayed out of the sun.
What? And I look like I've been in the sun, do I? Mm.
There's a woman in the shop around the corner that me and Nick go to who think we look... She refers to us as granddads because there were some kids in there and they thought... How old do you think we were? 70 or something?
I think that they were about 20.
They saw
us in the shop and they nudged each other and then they left. And as we approached the till, the woman was laughing and we thought...
At us.
Yeah. And we just assumed that they'd all recognised me off the telly. I get it a lot. A bit. I get it a bit. Sometimes. And I get birthday cards from my parents. And So we got up to the till, and they're like, she's laughing at us. Oh, we've already told this story. This is just for your benefit. And she goes, you never guess what those kids were saying. And we say, what? And they said, that's what we'll look like in 50 years.
Brilliant.
50 years.
Brilliant.
Was it 50 or 30?
No, it was 50 years. Plus, like, you had that. So they're about 20. And so they've seen us and gone, about 70.
To be fair, when you're young, you think everyone's older than they look.
Not when you're 20. Maybe when you're 4, you think, I can't tell the difference in any of these
people. I mean, it was early.
You probably imagined that the 20-year-olds were 20 when they were probably only 14.
No, they were older than 14.
Well, you see, you're doing to them what they did to you.
No, they were 20.
About 20.
They were 20. They had their Bart Simpson's backpacks and Swatch. I don't know anything about youth culture.
Swatch watches.
Their Swatch watches. And, they had their Swatches.
Sergio Cecchini tracksuit tops.
They had their Swatch watches. They had their Swatches. You go, what? Swatch watches? No, they had like big books of fabric that they were going to pick their three-piece sweets with. Classic, like classic 14-year-olds.
I like Pokemon Go.
Pokemon gone.
Gone. Something like that. Something. Okay,
With Neil and I, my friend lives in Stony Stratford, and the pub in Stony Stratford that is his local is the actual pub that they filmed with Neil and I in. So they must have had to construct quite a lot of sets in there to make it look like London, but that's an interesting fun fact.
It's always like this, Tom. Yeah. It is always like this.
I'm realising that.
Okay. And you were in Ideal with Johnny Vegas?
I was in Ideal.
Nick, you've
Ideal.
Worked with Johnny Vegas?
I have worked with Johnny Vegas, lovely man. And yeah, Baby Cow. Man.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course, it was a Baby Cow production.
And Baby Cow, yeah.
Lots of series of Ideal.
Seven
as well.
Series we did, yeah. Yeah, and we got to the point where we thought, oh, we're definitely going to get Series 8, and that's when they cancelled it.
But it felt like everyone in it was almost... There was lots of
got
people
to,
who were...
Series 7. Made a lot of first series. I've made a lot of first series. I can only dream of...
Series 7.
The bond that you would have forged between the returning crew and cast members over those seven seasons.
Yeah, it was close, Nick. It was close. Still, all that to come. You're only 26.
I had three series of Uncle. Watched that kid grow up before my eyes.
Yep.
Can't get him to do anything now. That's what happens when you put your career in the hands of a child.
He's your agent as well, isn't he?
He is. Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, contractually bound. Takes 75% of everything I make, which I said was too high, but he said, no way. What do you think of these swatches? And I was like, I like the Damask. Nick and Amy Dunn are the main characters in which movie?
Nick and Amy Dunn.
Nick and Amy Dunn. Is that 9 months?
No.
Oh, that would
not
be good.
They're not
though.
All Hugh Grant related, I have to point out. I don't think
Nick
you're going to get this.
And Amy Dunn. Can we have the four... The four options.
Interstellar, Boyhood, Gone Girl, Divergent.
Oh, Gone Girl. Gone Girl, yeah.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Isla Nublar.
Okay. We're already there.
Yeah.
Jurassic Park. Okay.
From the film Jurassic Park.
Oh, okay.
Contains which theme park? Sorry, I wasn't quick enough to think of an alternate question. What's your favourite TV series that you went in?
Edge of Darkness.
Oh yeah, I haven't shown what I've never seen.
The one
never
that the movie was based on.
Yeah, don't watch the movie.
Who
watch
was
the
in
TV
the movie?
Series.
It wasn't Mel Gibson.
It was Mel
was it?
Gibson.
Was
yeah.
it?
The TV show was Bob Peck
was
from
Bob
Jurassic
Peck.
Park.
It was Bob
from
Peck.
Jurassic Park,
yeah.
Of course.
It's amazing.
Clever girl.
Yeah. Best piece of telly ever made. It's still the best piece of telly ever made.
I really should watch that.
How many
I
episodes is
it?
It's four.
So you could binge it in an afternoon.
Yeah, you can binge it. Yeah. It's six.
Oh, you can still binge it. Is it what, half hours or
it's
hours?
It's been cut differently a couple of times. But you can get it on DVD, Blu-ray, all that. It's amazing.
Edge.
We're all learning.
You ever been to see The Darkness?
The Darkness never been to see them.
Great band.
Yeah. Are they, mate?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I met someone who was in The Darkness, actually. They're very nice. I think he was the drummer, I think. He was a nice fella.
They're all nice.
Well, nice fellas.
So, just did you... one of my favourite books, and I always try to read it before I've got an acting job, is the Michael Caine book on acting.
Oh, yeah.
All sorts of great tips for screen acting, like don't move your hands around too much, just keep them by your sides, that way they can cut together in the edit. Be very careful what you do with a prop, stuff like that. What's the best bit of what's the best thing that you learned off of working with Sean Connery?
If you want them to move in for a close up, take your trousers off.
Ah.
What?
Yeah.
Makes sense. They'll never film you.
So we were shooting at the Britannia Club and he'd had enough of the wides and all the establishing shots. So next time we walked back in, he had the top off of his costume on and he was wearing a pair of knee-length shorts underneath it. So,
oh my god,
so that's
we had
a
no
great
option but
thing.
To cut in.
That's great because you're never going to
not
do...
something I would ever do. But
no,
I
of
was
course
very
not.
Impressed.
But you were Indiana Jones's dad and James Bond.
Exactly.
Yes, there's a power play to it, isn't there? But it's yeah. very, very clever.
Yeah.
That is very good. But also, yeah. But yeah. Sometimes, I suppose for coverage, you would want to go in, wouldn't you? You would want to cut into like close-ups and stuff, but maybe the director wanted to do everything in a wide.
Yeah, which I think he did, because he's very cinematic, loved his widescreen.
But what, Sean just wanted some close-ups?
Yeah, he just wanted to just cut in, get to the money shots, please.
Because
we have been doing wides and mediums for a very long time.
And so like he basically
really
saved the day.
Oh yeah, essentially.
Did you think he was
like,
a fucking legend when he did that?
Oh yeah.
That's good.
That is good.
Yeah.
You heard it here first, fan club. It's 2019, but back in the day, it was acceptable to take your trousers off on a mix set. So we're going to play a game with you now.
Okay, this is my game, and it's called Better or Worse.
Okay.
And what you have to do, I'm going to give you a series of names, and you have to tell me whether the next person is better or worse than the person before. But don't worry, because it's entirely based on my own opinion. Starting with Clint Eastwood. Okay, Buddy Holly. Is Buddy Holly better or worse than Clint Eastwood?
Oh, worse. I'd say worse.
Better.
I'm going to say worse.
Of course he's worse. He died in a plane crash.
Patrick Swayze. Better or worse than Buddy Holly?
Patrick Swayze is better.
Better. I'd say better.
Yeah, I think worse.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's so controversial.
Yeah,
this is
wrong.
It's only my opinion.
Buddy Holly wasn't in Roadhouse.
Dean
and
Martin.
I say Roadhouse, but I meant Dirty Dancing.
Dean Martin, better or worse than Patrick Swayze?
Better.
Dean Martin, better.
Better, yeah, correct.
Better.
Jimmy Nail, better or worse than Dean Martin?
Was
We're
he
not
in
saying
our
Jimmy
country
Nail?
In the north?
He wasn't in it.
But worse than Dean Martin.
He is worse, but he's a high card, like Jimmy
he's
Nail.
A high card.
My
yeah,
favourite TV
shoes.
Show is season 2 of Crocodile Shoes. Carry on.
Jimmy Nail. Oh, Jimi Hendrix, better or worse than Jimmy Nail?
Better.
Much better.
Better, okay. Mel B from the Spice Girls, better or worse than Jimi Hendrix?
Worse, she's worse.
Worse, correct. Mel C, better or worse than Mel B?
Oh, better.
Better, correct, yeah.
I don't know.
Mel Smith, better or worse than Mel C?
Better.
Better, yeah.
Better. No, and worse.
Stanley
better. Better.
Stanley Kubrick, better or worse than Mel Smith?
The ultimate
Kubrick,
disaster movie.
Only just better than
better,
Mel Smith.
Better than Mel
Kubrick
Smith.
Kubrick is better
yes.
than Mel Smith. I don't
seven.
Know.
Seven! It's a good score.
Oh, well done. You got seven there. That means that you're in the same league as Hayley Campbell, Brett Goldstein, Charlie Higson, Matthew Holness, Jim Hoskin, Laura Lex, Esther Smith, Ian Smith, Josh Widdicombe, and Sean McLaughlin. But you weren't quite as good as John Niven and Sean Harris with 10, Daniel Cook, Daniel Lawrence, Taylor, Michael Legg, Solomon Gray with 9, Claudie Blakely, Jordan Brooks, Suze Kempner, Evelyn Mott, Paul F. Taylor, and Rebecca Shorrocks, Mark Smith, and Carl Theobald with 8. But you were better than Drunk Women Solving Crime with 6, Colin Holt, Andy Kindler, Marek Larwood, Lucy Porter, Richard Sandling, Mark Simmons, David Trent, Yasmin Akram, Rob Deering with 5.
Better than them.
Jack Barry, Bunny Galore, Taylor Glenn, and Katie Wilkins with 4, and Sam Ashurst with 3.
Wow.
So,
get on.
Well done. You did really well. You did really well. You got 7, which is just about average.
Thanks.
So, well done. Just got one final question for you, and that is, which character does Tim Allen voice in Toy... Oh, fuck off. Although, my parents were at my house the other day and put Toy Story on to just keep them occupied while I was busy doing something else. And at one point, one of them said, to infinity and beyond. And my mum said, does that come from this?
Oh.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
Beautiful. That's
unbelievable.
Lovely.
So, thank you very much for
coming
for climbing all the way up to the clubhouse.
Thanks so much.
Cheat is on Monday.
Cheat is on Monday
on
at
9 ITV,
and it runs consecutively until Thursday.
Oh, that's nice.
What's your favourite channel to work for?
Favourite channel to work for? Don't have one.
Like them all.
Well, Channel 4 probably. I've got to be honest.
And why is that?
The favourite things I've done have been on Channel 4.
Very good at promoting things as well, aren't they? Very good.
I don't mind Sky's money. I won't argue with that. So, thank you for listening.
You've been listening to a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.